It feels like it's been a full morning already of good things. But I really do think that Job is a really good book for us to be looking at right now. So I hope you can come along with me for this third installment of the book of Job. So 3 weeks ago, I gave a bit of an overview of the book of Job. Really that in some ways in that book, we have two stories. The first story and the first Job come from sort of a fairy tale that comprises the first two chapters of Job and the last chapter of Job, which is chapters 1, 2, and 42. So if you're counting, that means we've got 39 chapters in the middle that aren't the story of Job. Those first two chapters and the last chapter are where we hear the story of Job, the good man, the prosperous one. But a member of God's court decides that he doesn't trust Job being so pious. He thinks Job is only pious and righteous because he's a wealthy man with a great family, lots of stuff. So this guy, this accuser, or ha-Satan, which is where we've sort of concocted this idea of Satan from, even though in this story, ha-Satan is just an accuser, convinces God to let him test Job. So, eventually, very short version, Job's servants, livestock, children, and his very health are taken away from him. And it's in this story that Job earns the phrase, the patience of Job, that we refer to sometimes, because he simply seems to take this suffering and also to take the justification for it without much question. And then patient Job is rewarded with this restoration of fortune that Daniel read for us. Because he was so patient amidst all this suffering, he got new flocks, new servants, new gold, new kids. Yay. But the images on the front of your bulletin cover are actually images from this fairy tale sort of at the beginning and end of Job. The good fortune of Job in chapter 1 and the restored fortune of Job in chapter 42. In some ways, they're very similar pictures, but that's part of what we're looking at today is the similarities and differences of sort of the beginning and the ending and the happy ending. So then there's this intermission to the story of patient Job, this 39-chapter detour in which Job is actually very impatient. He laments his suffering, he laments his birth, and he demands that God give an accounting for the unjust suffering. But Job would not be silenced by the darkness in which he found himself, chapter 14 reads, nor by the deep gloom that covered his face. So 3 weeks ago, when we were beginning this series on Job, Louise led us in singing new verses to the hymn, Come Bring Your Burdens to God. I don't know if you remember that, but we sang in the spirit of Job, Come Bring Your Anger to God. Come Bring Your Suffering to God. Come Bring Your Loud Voices. And then last week, Naomi Washington Leephart invited us into a deeper conversation with Job. And she put Job in conversation with Dr. John Gottman of the Relationship Research Institute. And his work has to do with looking at how couples give bids for each other's attention and tracking that how if you see how couples respond to each other's bids, you can see, especially with certain negative responses, contempt, criticism, stonewalling, and defensiveness, that these are high predictors of divorce later on in life and high indicators of the current toxicity of a relationship. So the lectionary text for Job last week was God's response to Job, a pretty slamming rebuttal to Job, spoken out of a storm. And Naomi was asking us, is the God that we're presented with here, the God in Job, is this a gaslighting God and a toxic relationship partner? And if so, how must we respond? These are hard questions and not the kind of thing that you usually think about coming from the pulpit on a Sunday morning, but really important questions. And it's a question that might feel shocking for a Christian pulpit, I think. But these questions are actually very much in the vein of Jewish teaching and Midrash on the book of Job. And as I was working on this sermon yesterday, Taman said to me, Have you seen today's news? Which in this day and age is a horrible question because, yeah, it could be just about anything, it feels like. And I had not heard the news at that point. But as you know, Matt has already referred to this morning, we were getting news about the shooting that was happening in Pittsburgh at the Tree of Life Synagogue. We now know that 11 people died from that and more were injured. That was within a 72-hour window this week where there were three hate crimes. The killing of the 11 in the synagogue in Pittsburgh by a man who had posted online anti-Semitic words. The killing of two African Americans in a grocery store in Kentucky that was actually supposed to be a black church shooting, but the door was locked. So we went to the grocery store, and the white man who did those shootings apparently responded. A white man came in and with a gun and said, "Stop shooting." And the shooter said, "Don't worry, I won't shoot you. Whites don't kill whites." So fun news. And then the explosive devices mailed to Democratic politicians and high-profile Democratic supporters. That's 72 hours of our week this week. But in light of the most recent shooting du jour yesterday in the Jewish synagogue, I found myself wanting to know more about Jewish readings of the book of Job. Surely they have much to say about undeserved suffering. I ended up finding a really interesting essay called Job, the Open Book, by a contemporary Jewish poet. And I've only seen her name in print, so I might not be pronouncing it right. Alicia Ostreicher. She writes, "From the wellspring of the book of Job, there flows a river of living waters, of opposition to authority within Judaism that has affected all of Western history. The saying, 2 Jews, 3 opinions, marks Jewish culture as a culture that values argument. Is there another major religion in which human beings habitually argue with their God? Is there another major religion so preoccupied with dissent and with issues of social justice?" she asks. "The idea of interrogating God has streamed through Jewish literature for centuries, and in the post-Holocaust world, it assumes major proportions." She goes on, "We may remember that historical Judaism originates in a slave rebellion and an advocacy of freedom, which continue to resound in the aspirations and rhetoric of oppressed people throughout the world. The role of the prophets includes a steady attack on the corruptions of the Israelite ruling classes, kings and priests alike. Notwithstanding the centrality of ritual in the Israelite community, Isaiah, for example, is the mouthpiece of a God who 2.5 millennia ago said, 'I hate, I despise your offerings,' and demanded that his people feed the hungry, clothe the naked, and help the oppressed. Social justice, as opposed to whatever authority resists it, including the authority of God himself, is a core motivation in Jewish history," she says. "As a marginal population, Jewish writers have been social critics. And as a people whose survival depended on a book and not a territory, they developed intellectual institutions whereby continual study and constant reinterpretation of that book was the highest vocation to which a person could aspire." So a voice such as Job's, even a voice that dares to curse God, is given a place very much within the stream of Judaism, not outside it. And so I wonder, what does this tradition do with the happily ever after, the happy ending of Job? For that's where the lectionary takes us today, back to this little prose fairy tale with its spoonful of sugared happy ending to wash down the bitter words of the previous 41 chapters. I'm reminded of the way that my Kurdish friends from northern Iraq taught me to drink tea. Instead of sweetening their tea by pouring granulated sugar in the tea and stirring it in until it dissolves, they would put a lump of sugar on their tongue and then keep it there as they sipped black tea. It seemed like a great idea, but it was actually a very jarring experience for me because each sip was this clash of like really sweet and really bitter because the tea wasn't in your mouth long enough to dissolve the sugar and really mix it. And for me, I kept thinking of this with reading this, the book of Job, and then coming to this happily ever after ending. It felt like drinking a whole cup of tea unsweetened, only to be given a lump of sugar for my tongue at the end, when there's one swig of tea left, and then in a valiant attempt to sweeten the last swig of the book. But even a whole lump of sugar can't cancel the bitterness. It just leaves you with this confusing clash of too bitter and too sweet in your mouth. And then you're left with a lump of sugar on your tongue, which is just sort of too much of a good thing, too late. But anyhow, there you go. Kurdish cuisine, it fits, right? I don't know what. So what, you may ask, is wrong with this happy ending? Because a happy ending, a happily ever after, sounds pretty good right about now. And isn't that what Job deserves after all of his suffering? And yes, of course Job deserves resolution and restoration. But what does restoration look like in the face of the loss of your whole family? Here again, in Alicia Ostreicher's powerful words, "But when I think of the supposedly happy ending in which Job has 10 nice new sons and daughters to replace the ones God killed off in a bet, I feel I'm hearing a scream thousands of years old, or as if that scream inhabits my own throat. For I too am a mother. To me, the reparation offered in the epilogue is obscene. I imagine that one day Job's wife, which is to say, collective womankind, will gather the chutzpah to question God the way Abraham did, the way Jeremiah did, the way her husband did. I try to imagine her confrontation with God and what she demands as reparation. That day is not yet and may not be for centuries, she says, yet the book of Job asks me to imagine it. Perhaps the book of Job asks me to imagine all those who have been silenced, all who have been consigned to non-entity, at last finding their voices, at last demanding response. The poor, the illiterate, the sexual minority, the victims of war and violence, the earth itself. And I think she's right. I think these are the things that the book of Job asks us to imagine. But unlike her, I think that the day is here, that the time is now to do so. One of the issues that came up in the first week of John Rudy's Adult Christian Ed series that we've had here in October at CMCL was a discussion on this hypothetical situation of, you know, when an intruder comes into your home and is threatening violence against your family, what do? Can you manage to be nonviolent? And one of you, I don't remember who it was, said, well, you can't expect yourself to suddenly and for the first time do a tremendously difficult countercultural act in a moment of extreme stress. If a creative act of nonviolent resistance is what you hope you'll do, you cannot leave it to adrenaline and epiphany in the moment. In order to improvise in the moment, you must have practiced the melody 1,000 times and know your instrument and your scales as intimately as a lover. If you want to be able to use a muscle, you must practice it. One of the things we are seeing in our culture in this moment is the realization that our muscles of questioning authority, demanding accountability in any significant way, are critically deconditioned. We see this in the facts of the rampant isms in our country. We see this in clergy abuse and domestic violence. We are better practiced at obedience and deference to authority than we are at saying no to injustice, no matter whose hands it comes from. I believe it is one of the reasons that much of American Christianity seems to have rolled over belly up in front of a president who doesn't even claim to be a Christian and who doesn't even pay lip service to gospel ethics. We have deferred to and worshiped far too easily anything with a "Hello, my name is God" sticker attached, with far too little questioning of where the label came from and whether it is in fact the living God. Many of the stories in the Bible were simply not written to be taken literally. Readers and listeners were assumed to be grappling with the stories, assumed to be questioning whether the God in this story or that was really Yahweh or in fact a golden calf. The Bible was written with the expectation that we would argue with it, that we would seek to expose what was not godly and refuse to bow down before anything or anyone that turned out to be an idol. But these, again, are muscles that require practice, and American Christianity is not a very athletic endeavor. We parent in such a way that we expect obedience, just because I'm older, because I'm wiser, because I have responsibilities you don't understand yet, because I know what's best for you better than you do for yourself. We parent pretty much exactly in the mold of the God of Job. And then we wonder why we have no idea how to stand up to authority when we know in our heart and our mind and our gut that what's happening is wrong. I see in the New Testament many responses to the God of Job, the way Jesus refuses to play a game of temptation, the way God refuses to be put to tests, the way Jesus gets called on his mistakes, for example, by the Syrophoenician woman he refused to help until she insisted on her worth and value. And Jesus miraculously didn't respond with defensiveness. He changed his mind. He acknowledged that she was right, and he made corrective action. Thank God, fragility, thy name is not Jesus, which is something that those of us who struggle with white fragility or male fragility, you name the fragility, we might do well to take a look at, since we call Jesus our exemplar. I see that we are a culture who will easily sacrifice justice for a chance at the happy ending like Job had, a chance at the American dream. We will voluntarily pay billions into a lottery system and not find it problematic at all for one person to get the jackpot, because it could be us. Job won the jackpot. Yes, he suffered, and it was unjust, but all Job's children, all Job's servants, all the creaturely life that was dependent on him died. None of them received restoration for their unjust suffering or death. I think it's one of the reasons that America has such widespread depression and unhappiness. I think we know at a level that we cannot face in the light of day that whatever happy ending or American dream we are living is one in which too many people are missing. Job's family and servants and livestock got red-shirted Star Trek style. They were dispensables. It could still be considered a happy and just ending, even though they died. Who were the dispensables in the happy ending of the American dream? Who were the dispensables in our church institutions, in our schools? Who were the dispensables within ourselves? What parts of our identities or pasts do we simply ignore? And nothing shuts up dissent more than being told, you're the recipient of the happy ending. Job stopped complaining to God about the injustices of the world once his fortunes were restored. It's the deal with the devil. You accept the happy ending, so you can't complain anymore. And I'll end again with the words from Alicia Ostreicher. First, she quotes Deuteronomy, justice, justice shalt thou pursue. Someone must choose justice. Someone must define it. If not we, who? In the book of Job, God is unable to choose justice until God challenges him. And even then, we may remain skeptical. Is the restoration of one man's fortunes and the provision of 10 new children to replace 10 murdered ones a sufficient answer to the evil and suffering in the world? Does it take care of human poverty, war, violence, and greed? It may be that the Holy One waits for us to issue our challenge. Perhaps God does not know how to be just until human beings demand it. Amen.